Well, I thought of a few things that happened back when I was a kid, back about when one of those years when I was a little Derrick boy. We were haying along about the time I was telling you about the episode of me and Ariel, Owen and Dad. But one of those days, in one of those years, we'd quit for dinner and go on the hay wagon and was coming up home. And of course, we were coming up here and we'd have to feed the horses and tend them. And I was give out. I was just a kid. And I slipped off the back of the wagon as we came in the yard and run up the bar pit and into the front of the house, slipped in front of the house. I thought I was too tired to help tend the horses or help May and Mother with dinner. And I crawled in under an old couch that we had, old bed we had in the front room. Thought I'll just stay here out of sight for a few minutes until they come in for dinner and then I'll get up and eat dinner. But I went to sleep, and I never did come to. Till they was eating supper that night, slept all afternoon, never moved the kids. When I woke up and heard them stirring around, it was dark, and that's what crawled out, came in, and they wanted to know where I'd been. So I told them where I'd been, what I'd done. Owen said, if I'd known you was under there, I'd throw a bucket of water on you. And I'm sure he would have done. But you take a little boy out in the hot sun, ride a Derrick horse, all day long, day after day, month after month. Seems like a long life. But anyway, that's one of the stories. Now, I don't suppose those older kids will think that's what happened, but they hunted all afternoon trying to find me. And yeah, they said they had an off-time run without Derrick boy. Now, I believe it was in 1939, either 1938 or 39, but we were just finishing up the haying, last of June, first of July. Lamont Hyde came down here, and I had a good saddle horse, good horse. Sorrel, well, strip-faced mare, that was a good mare. And he said, let's ride our horses to Bear Lake and spend the 4th of July over there and then come back. All right. Gosh. I looked at Reed and he said, I'll milk the cows, go ahead. So we saddled up that mare that morning and he saddled up his and I took a couple quilts and tied it in a coat. Oh, I remember a can or two of pork and beans and a few things we could eat, because I knew we was going to have to stay one night up in those hills. We couldn't make it to Bear Lake in one day. We figured 2 days over and a couple days there and 2 days back. Now, as we went up High Creek Canyon and up the North Fork, down into Bear Lake, down into Franklin Basin, then we went east over the hill from Franklin Basin. We just kind of picking our trail, didn't matter. And I hit a big canyon over there and it was starting to get long in the afternoon. We'd stop and have dinner somewhere, but I was trying to find a place to camp. So I started down this canyon. Lamont kind of let me take lead because he didn't know where he was going. I did, I thought. We got clear down Logan Canyon. Went across the highway and across the river. Nice little green area over there, and we staked our horses there and made camp for the night. Slept there that night. Had water. Next morning we went back up that canyon. Got up there about right and headed east. Oh, that was pretty country. We ended up right up on the top of the mountain, right west of Fish Haven. And I said, well, there's got to be a road here somewhere. So we turned it, fiddled around, found a road, and came down into Fish Haven. And that's where we was going to spend 4th of July. So we went over to a fine old farmer there, and I've often thought of him. And I said to him, We're from Lewiston. We've come over here to spend a load of horses through the hills. Going to spend the 4th of July here. I was wondering if you had a pasture we could turn our horses in. And if we could sleep on your haystack. And he said, do you boys smoke? I said, no, neither one of us smoke. He said, all right, you can sleep on my haystack. And there's a pasture right down there. Pointed around towards the lake. Said, you can go in that gate and put your horses in there. And that'd be just fine. A little grass there. They can drink out of the lake. And they can rest a couple of days before you head back. So we did that. We fiddled around there at Fish Haven, loafed around a little. Spent that day and the next day. And I think the next day we started home. But anyway, when I went, thanked him for the use of his haystack, asked to pay him for the pasture, and he said, no. No, I can't charge you for that. That belongs to Utah Power. Light. That's good land. Well, he said, everybody else around here pastures that. And they never charge anybody, and I know. And I knew there wouldn't be any of those Utah Power boys around 4th of July. They all take weekend off, week off, days off, celebrate. So it's been nice to have you here. And I assured him we was glad to, for his hospitality. So we got on our horses that morning and headed west. I had a little better feel for the country as I was coming back than I did going. But up in the top of those mountains, I got turned around. And that was my first experience of being turned around. I was going west, but it was east to me. And I knew I was going west, so I could tell that by the sun. We got up on a mountain. Oh, that was pretty country. Grass was pretty all through those hills. Riding along there with not a care in the world. Only in fact, I wished I wasn't turned around. And I got up on this mountain and looked down into the next valley. I could see a road. Here was a car coming, so I kicked that mare in the belly and down that mountain we come on around. I hailed that car down and I said, now I'm... And whether I'm lost or what, but I'm turned around in my direction, and would you tell me, is this Franklin Basin? Yes. He said, this is a Franklin Basin road. And I said, and you're going south? And he said, yeah. And I said, all right, then I'm straight, know where I am. He kind of laughed, like, what's the matter with that kid if you're lost? But anyway, so I wanted to go to Steam Mill. I knew White's Canyon. I knew where I wanted to go, but I wanted to go to Steam Mill. And we wanted to hit White Pine, Tony Grove, come down through High Creek Canyon, High Creek Lake. But I wanted to go to Steam Mill Lake. And we went over to this sheep herder. It was camped there. And visited with him a few minutes, and I said to him, now, sir, do you know how to get to Steam Mill Lake? And he stood out there and he pointed in a direction and went on with a speech of how those certain trees out on that hill. Gave about a 5-minute discourse about the direction and stopped and said, now that isn't the way. Then he started out on another lingo. When he got through with that, that wasn't the way. I didn't want to know the way not to go. I wanted to know the way to go. And after 3 tries of that, I said, will this trail lead to it? And he said, yes. And so we just rode off. I never did get to Steam Mill Lake. We got back up that canyon that I thought was Steam Mill Canyon. That's where we camped for the night. We found a little water, but I never did get there. Went on down around the other way and got to White Pine, Tony Grove, back into High Creek Lake and home. But that was quite a trip. I've always thought about that. But I've never forgot the darn old sheep herder and all that time telling us the way not to go. I didn't want to know that. I always want to know the way to go. I remember as we camped that night in the hunting of Steam Mill Lake. I found Steam Mill Lake many years later, but I came in from the other direction. And we camped, and the tide, though, that darn horse is too close to bed. And that mare of mine snorted and stomped, carried on all night. I tied her too close, I guess. I was telling that story, and somebody said, well, maybe she was scared something away. And I said, well, maybe all she was doing was just keeping me awake. And they said, well, how did you dare stay there? And I had developed a habit of, when I went to bed, I slept lots of places. I just make my bed, kneel down inside the bed, and ask Lord to give me a good night's rest and protect me for the night and go to sleep. And I'd come a long ways from when my parents died, and I was too scared to even go outside in the dark. I'd finally come a long ways. Well, let's check here. Back in one of those years, and I can't remember when it was, must have been about 1930 or, oh, I'd have been 10 years old, but somewhere in that area. I was a paper boy. I can look this up later, but it's the year they tore out all the trees. Right west of the church house up here, there used to be a big ball diamond. It was surrounded around the edges by those great big poplar trees. And they had a ball diamond out there. And they decided to do away with the ball diamond. It belonged to church property, and most of all games went on Sunday. And gosh, you'd have a rip-roaring ball game out there, and you'd have more people out there with church house and church. And it all belonged to church, so they kind of made some changes, and they tore all that up and moved the grandstand. And anyway, when they pulled those trees out, pushed the loose dirt in. And I was up there, and this day's blank to me. Lorne Rogers was with me, and I asked him the other day a little about it, and he'd about forgot it. But anyway, I was riding that mare of mine, that's gray snip-nosed mare that we called Snip. Finest saddle mare as a kid could have. And she went across, and she was going on full tilt, and it wasn't uncommon for me to ride a horse on dead run. And she went into one of those with loose dirt, and her front feet went down, and she rolled endways with me. And I laid out there, not colder than a cucumber, I guess. Jerry Tyner was the druggist, and they took me over there, and there was a doctor there from some source. Anyway, they checked me over and got me home, and I came to the next day. I've asked a lot of people about what happened that day, but I never did ever get much information about it. That was one blank day. Still is. I remember when Reed and I saw the show Jesse James. When they was robbing a bank or doing something, they was trying to get out of town, and Jesse's horse rolled with him, but he got off. As the horse fell, he kicked loose and got out of the way. Now the stunt rider and that horse rolled somewhat similar to what my mare did. The money wasn't very plentiful back in those years. And anyway, read in the newspaper where the stunt rider that rode on that, when that horse fell, they paid him $1,700. Reed said, well, you didn't get $1,700 for your role. But, I'm not sure which year that was, but I thought I'd enter this here. In the year, in the summer of 1940, President Roosevelt had asked that every young man that was available come in and spend a year in the Army. And there was quite a discussion between the kids around. Bishop talked to me about going on a mission. And he said, do you need to wait till Howard gets home or not? And I said, I'll figure that out, let you know. And so we struggled around here with everything we had. And Howard was out, and he'd been out a year and a half. So I told the bishop I'd go any time after the 1st of December. So he sent the papers in, and they sent me a call to go to the Southern States the 6th of January, 1941. Oh, we'd top beats. I'd been an assistant cow tester, and I'd made a little money, and I'd run around here all year trying to gather up some money. Anyway, we got all through work, got the beats all off, and we like to never got through. The month of October, we top beats and snow domes every day. Every day. To get the trucks out of the field, we'd hook a cat on it, 4 to 6 head horses. And it was wet and cold, miserable old fall. In November, it straightened out, and we top beats most of November. Finally got done. Saul Heyer called me up. He was first counselor in state presidency. He lived down there where Bryce Gilbert lives. It's his farm. And he said, Lynn, I'd like you to haul pulp for me Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, I believe. So I'd work for him those days a week. And I'd work for, and Mel Gilbert seen me hauling pulp, and he said, hey, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm hauling pulp. And he said, you haul every day? And I said, no, just about every other day. And he said, well, the days you don't haul pulp for him, come haul pulp for me. Well, you take a team, big old beat rack, wagon, go down and shovel on 5-ton pulp. Nice, good old scoop shovel. Mel's team would pull. I didn't have any trouble with Mel's team. But Saul Heyer's team. Cap and was one of the horses' names. Turk was the other one. Turk could give you everything he had. Cap pulled his horse. And just depending on how much fear he had of you. He was the biggest horse, but he was the biggest nuisance too. It was a pretty good team, but he got right down to pulling the load. Saul, he'd go down on his day and get 3-ton pulp. And when I'd show up there the next morning, he'd say, well, I didn't get quite enough. Would you bring 5-ton home? The reason he never got 5-ton, he couldn't pull. He couldn't get out. He'd hoop and holler and yell. Now, I'd been raised to be a teamster. My father was a good horseman, brothers. Good horsemen. We had good horses. We'd hook on load, we got out. Well, one day that Cap horse quit me. So I went and got a piece of chain, about 2 feet long. And I got a hold of his bit. So I got around to his side and I got a hold of his bit. Bridle with one hand, with my left hand, and I beat that son of a gun on the ribs with that chain. And I hollered, Cap. and a few other words that I was quite fluent with. I could cuss real bad. Anyway, that was the treatment. Generally, I always thought you had to cuss a balky horse anyway. And so when I spoke to that horse, he knew what I meant. Well, I never had any more trouble with him. Every day, Salt said, gosh, you got a nice little pup. And he'd always say, I'll come help you. But he never got there. And I was always grateful he didn't. Because I'd back down in that pulp silo. It was on an incline, it was slick, and horses had to be shod good. And then I'd start out. I'd take my big old sheepskin coat off and hang it on the horse's hand, keep the coat warm, roll up my sleeves, start shoveling pulp. On Saturdays, I had to get two loads. Get one load to feed for Saturday and then feed it. Then go get another load to feed for Sunday. And I got two stories here. Now, one day I pulled down in there on a Saturday for a second load. Clarence Weiser, fine man, but he always wore a great big old fur coat. He had rheumatism real bad and a lot of problems. And I didn't know all about his health. I didn't know much about him. I knew him. Anyway, there he had great big old mittens on and great big old fur cap and a great big old fur coat. And he was trying to get a little pulp. And he'd throw on three or four little shovelfuls, and then he'd swing this arm, and he'd swing that arm. And I back down in there at the side of him and let the sideboard down. And oh, there was a cold wind out of the north, but you got right down between that wagon. The pulp was to the north of the wagon. And there was a little steam coming off that pulp, and you'd get right down between the wagon and the pulp. And I took my coat off and rolled up my sleeves. Pulled mirror pads up and bent over and went to work with that shovel. And old Clarence, he'd say, Brother Rollins, put on your coat, you'll freeze. And I said, good land, Clarence, take your coat off and go to work. Work up sweat, it'll cure all your affliction. And I badgered him. He says, put on your coat. Well, I got the 5-ton on. I'd put up the sideboard and finished my load. And he was still trying to get that couple of ton of pulp that he was doing. I said, well, I'd help you, Clarence, but I gotta go. I gotta go get this home. I got a date with a girl that I just don't really want to miss it. Oh, I'll make it, he said. I'm glad he had faith. I didn't know he did. But anyway, he never did forget that, I guess. But now back here to one of these other stories. One of those days was on a Thursday, I believe, or Wednesday or Thursday. Anyway, it was the day that I had the appointment to meet with the stake presidency to see about going on a mission. And I had 5-ton pulp on that wagon, and I started out. And I was coming out all right. And Saul Heyer walked around the end of that pit. That cap horse seen him and just throwed up his head and quit. And started back down. I started back down into that silo. And Saul run around and throwed a big block behind that wheel. And I said, let me back down. And he said, no, I won't leave you in trouble. I'll go get someone to hook on you. And I said, no, you won't. I said, you just stand there and, well, what can I do? And I said, you just stand there and be quiet for a minute. And we'll get out. So he stood there and didn't say any more. And that horse had turned his head right in to the other horse so he could watch me. And I got my line straightened around there. Didn't have a whip. I could use the end of the line. I could raise a welt on a horse with the end of the line. I sit there, and pretty soon that horse throw his head around straight and up. And I hit him with the end of that line and screamed at him. And then I spoke to him just the way I did. I'd actually forgot Saul was there. I talked to that horse just like I did the day I pretty near beat him half to death with a chain. And we went right out, and right up over the scales, and he wouldn't, I couldn't hardly stop while they weighed. He just ran, and Saul walked up beside the wagon, and he said, "I just can't understand that horse pulling," and that kind of language. Well, I was embarrassed, and I said, "Well, you drove him," and he said, "I never talked to him that way." I come on home, unhooked off a load pump, put the team in the barn, and unharnessed them, got them ready for night, and fed them, and getting in the car ready to go. And went home and helped Reed chore and had a bath, and I said, "Well, Reed, I guess my mission's all off." I said, told him about it, and I said, "Now I got to go face that steak princy tonight. Maybe there's no sense going, because I guess I blew it." "Oh," he said, "I believe I'd go. I believe I'd go. Yeah." So I got over there at the appointed hour and went into the old steak office, which was right up in the middle of Richmond, south of the drugstore, south of the post office in Richmond. Or at least where the post office now is. Went in there and President Pond said, "Lindsey Rollins." "Yeah. Alf Rollins' boy." "Yeah? Which one?" "Last one." "Well, my gosh, haven't you got a brother on a mission?" "Yeah, yeah. Yeah." "Brother President Heyer," he said. "Doesn't he come from your ward?" "Yeah, yeah, he does. In fact, he works for me. Calls him a pulp," he said. "Nah, my heart just sank." "Well, what do you think, President Heyer, about him going on a mission?" "My, he's ready to go," he said. "That's all he said." Ray said, "Well, President Pond said, that's good enough for me. I'll sign this and we'll just ship this right out. Now, you say you can go anytime in December, yeah?" I got the call back a little later, going to... I haven't thought about it. I told that story about to Clem Rollins one time, and Clem laughed. He said that all you did to Saul Heyer was one of the best speakers that we ever had in this country. And he said all you did was remind Saul when he was your age, because that's the way he acted. He said he had language just like that before he went on mission. He said he knew what he was doing. He said you just reminded him of him. I didn't know that, but anyway. So I got my mission call to go into the mission home in January the 6th, 1941. We had her farewell along in December, I'm not sure when. I brought a girl from Glencoe down to my farewell. Real fine gal. In fact, I'd been running around here with about three of them at different times. I talked to her, and I didn't really want to get anything serious. I planned a long time to go on a mission. I wanted a mission for you, serious. Anyway, she sat down in the audience between Ed Staggart and Glenn Cottle. Glenn Cottle was the milk tester. I was his flunky. And so I went up and sat down on that stand. I sat on that north seat in the rostrum. As I sat down after the opening song, I felt my father's hands come right down on top of my head, both hands, just like, and they stayed right there till I get up to talk. And I was a little bit confused. I didn't dare turn around and look back. And yet I hadn't been scared of anything for a long time. When I get up to talk, then those hands left me, and I've never felt them since. Anyway, Dow Lewis was a member of the bishopric that was conducting the farewell. He was first counselor. And he got up and he said, "This boy is leaving a fine young, pretty young wife home." And Bishop Hendricks said, "Hey, Dow, he not married? That was you that was married when you went on a mission, but he not married." And Dow went red and apologized to me and to the girl and to everybody, and he fouled him up. Now, Dow sometimes gave a right good speech, but that wasn't one of them. It fouled him up. When Dow went on a mission, he was a married man, which was common in his day. But anyway, we get shaped around. It was about the 21st, I believe, of December when I went through the temple for the first time. I should have gone earlier and hadn't gone a few more times. I'd known a little more about it. I've kind of recommended that to my own kids. And there were a lot of questions in my mind about the temple ceremony, and I was many years hunting out the answers. You couldn't seem to ask anybody, nobody'd tell you. I didn't know where to ask or who to ask. And anyway, where I did ask, never did find out. So I've kind of carried the policy of my own kids to go in there and then sit there and temple and try to explain all I know about it. Don't take long, but it kind of takes out some of the unknowing. I guess that's the right word. And so as I entered the mission home and spent 2 weeks down there, came home for the weekend. Bill Andre from Preston had his car down there. He came home for the weekend, or his dad come and got him, I don't know. But anyway, they were driving to Preston, and I came home and spent that last weekend here, and the next week I went back. Then on Wednesday, I headed for Mission Field. I'd made arrangements to stop off at Independence, Missouri, and spend a night with Howard. He was living at Leavenworth. Not the fort near the jail, but in the city of Leavenworth, Kansas. What happened, stayed overnight with him, gone train next day, and head for Atlanta, Georgia. Got to Atlanta on my birthday, the 19th of January, 1941, the day I turned 21 years of age. I met Blaine Hansey here in Hyde Park. I remembered him in school. He was years older than I was. He was there and in the office. And they shipped me right on to Mobile, Alabama, and I got down to Mobile, Alabama, 4 o'clock in the morning, and gosh, somebody met me at the train and took me over to the branch president's place, President Moore. And they said the only place available was right on that couch. And I said, "That's better than any train seat I'd ever saw." And this was at district conference. The district president was being released, go home, and Ned Woodruff from Pitcher Butte, Alberta, Canada. And a man by the name of George F. Badwin was being made the district president. He was a married man from Berkeley, California. He'd been out about a year. He was 10 years older than I was. Had a wife and a couple of kids down in California. Had a little store down there, a little fur store, I believe, and his wife was running that and supported him on a mission. He was a convert to the church when he was 18 years old. He'd been a Catholic all his life. Oh, and so here they wondered what to do. But they had an elder, John G. Knutson, from Salt Lake. He had been 18 months in South Africa. And they had closed the mission because of the war in Europe. And shipped him down there for his last 6 months. And he just wouldn't work. I don't think he'd ever worked. Never. Well, before the mission, I guess he worked afterwards, I don't know. I've never seen him since, but anyway. And he wouldn't work with me. They said, let's give him this green country hayseed to inspire him. Now, years later, at a mission reunion in Salt Lake, I saw Ned Woodruff standing there, his wife, Fred Boyer, several of those elders that were about through when I got there. But anyway, I walked up and took a hold of Ned Woodruff, and I said, Ned Woodruff. And he said, yes. He said, I can't place you. And I said, you better place me, you son of a gun. I'm the green country kid that you recommended. They put with Elder John G. Knutson. Inspire him and all. Ned just about sank. And he said, I hoped, as I've thought about that over the years, I've hoped I'd never see you. And he said, did he ever work? And I said, not with an outfit. But they sent us to Greenville, Alabama. My golly, for a kid that had just gone on a dead run, day and night. Get down there and get with a companion that would go to bed at sundown. 9 o'clock in the morning, he still had a pillow over his head and still in sleep. Just about drove me crazy, literally. That's when I wrote to Reed and told him he'd lied to me about a mission being the happiest 2 years of his life. And he wrote a letter back to me that the smoke just coiled out of that. Well, I'd been with him till about the 1st of March. He transferred me to Montgomery, Alabama. I'd complained a little to Elder Boyer. I asked Elder Boyer what to do. Elder Boyer and Elder Christofferson were country elders, and they stopped in to see us. And I thought that country elder looked like the thing to do. Those guys at least done something. But anyway, I said, do you have any suggestions? He just shook his head. No, I don't, he said. I said, I've just about read all the standard works of the church while he slept. And I noticed when we went somewhere and met people and they'd ask questions, I did the answering because he didn't know. And that was kind of sad. So, up in Montgomery was an Elder Brown, Roy, and an Elder, and Claire Hull, Whitney. I'd seen Claire before. I didn't know him, but I got well acquainted with him there, and so they traded places with us. And he went down there with Knutson, and I should have stayed there. I shouldn't have done that, I guess. But anyway, because about the 1st of April, they let Elder Knutson come home, and I was stuck with Brown, and Brown wasn't any better. This was my initiation to missionary work. Two elders that didn't know Sikkim, didn't know the gospel, didn't even want to learn. Elder Brown knew a little bit, but not much. And about the only thing he wanted to do was go to shows on, you know, 10 cent Western, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry. Every afternoon there in Montgomery, there was a show house. And I discovered, you know, you'd go see him for 10 cents, those powder burners. Oh, he'd go tracking in the morning. He didn't really care whether he worked. He'd write into President Whitaker every week for release. And then President Whitaker would write and haul him out. He didn't have very good eyes. His eyes bothered him, hurt him. I don't know what was the matter with him, but anyway. I discovered that you go to that shoal, if you'd make him stay there and see it twice, then his eyes hurt bad. He couldn't see shoal for a week. So every time we go to shoal, I'd follow him in there and then wouldn't let him out till we'd see it twice. We got down to where we'd only go to shoal once a week that way. But anyway, Elder Brown, I decided I wouldn't complain. I'd kept my mouth shut first place, been with Knutson, and I wouldn't have had Brown, I don't suppose. I could have went with Christofferson when Boyer went home. Boyer went home in April. And Knutson went home, and so they put Hull and Christofferson together. And that would have been a good, that would have been good duty. But anyway, I was with Brown and swore I'd never complain again. And I know he'd ride every week for release. Didn't feel good. He's sick. He wanted to go home. Presently, we'd ride back and haul him out. I'll give you a dishonorable release, but I won't give you an honorable release. Well, Brown thought he'd done enough work for an honorable release, but anyway. So finally, I wrote to President Whitaker, and I said, President, I in no way want to tell you how to run your mission or attend your missionaries. But if you... I know my companion rides every day for release, every week at least. And then he's mad and ornery, I can't hardly live with him, and then he gets another rebuke from you. And I'd like to suggest either do something about it or at least ignore him. So from that day till then, he never wrote Elder Brown a letter. No one. Elder Brown writes, why no chance for my letters? He'd get after me, why don't he ask me? Well, I don't know, I had a right to ask him. But while Elder Brown laid and slept in the morning, I studied the gospel. We were tracting in a Church of Christ area. They just built a new church house. And they were trying to get enough money out of there to build that church house. And they'd follow us and pick up our tracks. And that preacher'd tear into us. And Elder Brown never could defend the church. That bothered me. Oh, that bothered me. And I didn't know enough. They'd tear us apart, you wouldn't believe it. I got to where I was almost too scared to go tracking. We had a district conference in April, middle of April, down in Magnolia, Alabama, and I had a list of questions. At meeting Saturday night, it was pretty country, pretty time, moonlight night. And I was asking questions, and President Whitaker was answering them, and finally he said, hey, now wait a minute. Everybody needs to go to bed but me and you. Let's dismiss, and I'll sit right there on that table with you until you're satisfied. He knew what I was up again. Nobody had ever put up with Elder Brown any longer than 6 weeks, not at him 6 weeks. And I had to defend the church. Well, when he got through with me and got me straightened out, then I could handle those Church of Christ preachers. I went back and I could stand just about toe-to-toe with them as they tangled into us. And one day one of the members gave me some literature. That was the best thing ever done. And I went home and I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll trade you literature and promise to read every bit of yours. Guy, she loaded me down, and going home, Elder Brown said, why don't you throw that junk away? And I said, not till I've read it thoroughly. I need to know what they got and what they're talking about. Well, by the next morning, I had it all digested. From then on, Church of Christ preachers or none of the rest of them, I then knew what I needed to know. Then they would say, good morning, Elder, leave me alone. The greatest joy I believe a Protestant preacher has, if he can lick a Mormon elder, But the day comes that they can't look him, they respect him, and I found that out. But Elder Brown never got to that point. And along the line, and we was a-coming on in about July, and I was the only elder that had ever worked with Elder Brown that long. Nobody ever put up with him that long. Hull was with him the longest of anybody except me. And the branch president started coming to me for information. They'd ask Elder Brown a question, and he didn't know. And I would answer. And I may not have been too good of a diplomat. I've kind of regretted this part of the story. I tell you this one for information, but I regret this part of it. But when he discovered that I had passed him in knowledge and in understanding of the gospel and in approach, people would talk to me and they wouldn't talk to him. He was ignorant. He was rude. He was afraid they'd ask him something he didn't know. He'd have a speech that would just turn everybody off. He taught it negatively, and he didn't really care. And so I'd get a conversation, and he'd break it up intentionally. He didn't want people talking to me. He turned just as bitter could be. And I said, "Now look, Elder, don't do that. Don't you embarrass me anymore.